with billions gone, J.P. Morgan prepares to meet the shareholders.
What timing? The bank's annual meeting is tomorrow.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, May 14th.
Coming up, preparing for a possible Greek exit from the Eurozone.
The birds meet wind power.
Plus the digital camera assembled completely by robots.
It's all coming up right here on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The head of J.P. Morgan Chase, fresh from the disclosure that his traders lost at least $2 billion in a colossal bet gone wrong, is expected to have a difficult meeting with shareholders. As it happens, the bank's annual meeting is tomorrow in Tampa, Florida. And joining us for some context is Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning.
So, shareholder meeting, they just had this trading debacle. Could it be worse timing?
Worst, David, or the best? Well, it turns out that a lot of these votes have already been cast in the shareholder meeting. So there are few to no consequences, except possibly a lot of yelling that the executives will face.
What would they vote on anyway?
Well, shareholders there get what's called say on pay. That's about compensation for 2011, which was last year. So Jamie Dimon, the CEO, he's supposed to get $23 million for that year. Ina Drew, who's the chief investment officer, $15 million. And the shareholders will get to decide whether they get that money.
But as you say, they've already cast their vote and not much they can do at this point. Now, with apologies to Alanis Morissette, isn't that kind of ironic? Aren't banks always trying to please shareholders on these things?
Yes. In fact, you could argue that big, stupid bets like this were made to boost revenues, which then boost the stock price. But if that was the plan, it backfired badly. Since Friday, the stock has been down nearly 10%.
Yeah, it's really, and we'll see what it does when the market opens. Now, there are reports today that heads will soon roll at J.P. Morgan, just not Jamie Dimon's.
Right. That Ina Drew, the chief investment officer who I mentioned, she might resign as early as this week. The funny part is she's been trying to resign for over a month, reportedly.
Maybe she saw some of this coming.
Exactly. She saw the losses. But, you know, especially for shareholder meetings, they talk about optics, which is what things look like. And the optics of having her leave after this are immeasurable.
So a big question would be, if she does have to leave sort of abruptly, maybe not so abruptly for her if she saw this coming, will she get her money, the pay package?
She's very likely to get her money because that was for 2011. I mean, it depends on how bloody-minded the shareholders are, really, but she should.
Which will be a big part of the story that we're covering tomorrow. Marketplace's New York editor, Heidi Moore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now to the big news from Greece, where the political parties remain unable to form a new government more than a week after elections were held. There is a lot more open discussion today about the possibility that Greece is going to have to leave the Eurozone. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now from London with more. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with the latest news from Athens.
Well, the parties, as you say, are still wrangling, and if they can't agree by Thursday to form a new government, there will have to be another election. And that's worrying investors because the anti-austerity group Syriza looks set to win more votes. And if they formed a government, they might well turn their backs on austerity. Greece then might be denied any more bailout money, and there could then be a very messy and disorderly default.
And what about all of this talk that Greece is now more likely to have to leave the euro? Is that just talk or is it for real?
Well, there certainly is a lot of talk. I mean, over the weekend, we had news of a leaked document from the German finance ministry showing that Germany is prepared to put up cash to ease Greece's exit from the euro to minimize the damage. Now, we don't know how genuine that leaked document is, but some politicians and officials in Europe are now definitely talking quite openly about the possibility of Greece leaving the euro.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London, and let's get some analysis now from Julia Coronado. She is chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us this morning. From Paris. Julia, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, do you think that Greece is going to have to leave the Eurozone?
Look, the chances are rising every day. I think it's a distinct possibility. Bottom line is the Greek population is saying no to the terms of the bailout, and Germany is saying no room for compromise.
And what are the people saying there in Paris? You're in one of the key countries in the Eurozone. How are they feeling this morning?
It's a it's a pretty gloomy mood over here. I mean, already we're seeing the contagion. We're seeing borrowing costs in Italy and Spain shooting higher this morning. You know, there's a notion that there's a choice between growth and austerity. But bottom line is European countries are living beyond their means, and investors are less and less willing to finance those deficits. So it's a pretty difficult picture over here.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
In an effort to encourage more lending in China, the central bank there is cutting the amount of money that banks have to hold in reserve. China's looking for a boost after a series of disappointing economic indicators in recent days. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz has more on what this means for the U.S. economy.
China's central bank announced Saturday night it would make it easier for state banks to lend money. There are a couple of problems with that. Chinese banks already have ample room to lend, and if lending does pick up, that'll impact the cost of everything, says Chinese economist Andy Xie.
Inflation is going to be pushed up higher, and that's going to affect consumption and affect social stability.
It's not a great time for a disturbance in the balance of China's social stability. The government's not been looking too stable lately due to a political scandal involving Bo Xilai, a politician who is being groomed for China's top leadership. Higher inflation may also prevent the world's fastest rising consumer class from buying KFC, Apple products, and GM cars. And that, says Xie, is why Americans should pay attention to these recent fluctuations in China's economy. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Yahoo shares bucked the general downward trend of the stock market earlier today after news that Ross Levinson will become interim CEO. Scott Thompson is out as head of the company amid controversy over a padded resume. The Wall Street Journal also says Thompson told the board he's been diagnosed with cancer. Marketplace's Gregory Warner has more on what this means for the future of one of the most visited sites on the web.
It's not just switching around the nameplate. With each new CEO, Yahoo has looked into the mirror and tried to be a different company.
They've tried to compete with all the big boys in the race, and you know, they just didn't have what it took.
Richard Holway is the chairman for Tech Market View, a technology research firm in the UK. But don't call Yahoo a little guy yet, not with 700 million users.
There are almost no other sites in the world that have that sort of audience, and there's certainly no traditional media companies that have that sort of audience.
That's Henry Blodgett of Business Insider. He says that the interim CEO, Ross Levinson, is a better fit with a background most recently at Fox in digital media and, maybe more importantly, online advertising.
So hopefully, finally, there's a CEO whose background actually meshes with what Yahoo is.
Is and will be? I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Facebook is set to go public this week, which is going to create some overnight billionaires. One of them is Eduardo Saverin, who helped start the company. But news recently came in that Saverin has renounced his U.S. citizenship, meaning he will apparently avoid about $600 million in taxes on his new wealth.
Here to talk more about how Saverin will be benefiting from renouncing his U.S. citizenship is Jesse Drucker, reporter from Bloomberg News. Hello, Jesse.
Hey, how are you?
So why do you think this might be a useful time for him to be doing this with his citizenship?
Well, from a tax perspective, the way it works is that if you're a U.S. citizen, regardless of where you are around the world, if you sell stock in a U.S. company, in most types of U.S. companies, you're going to owe federal income taxes, capital gains taxes. But if you're not a U.S. citizen, then you don't owe any capital gains taxes. And the way it works is that if you are someone like Eduardo Saverin and you want to renounce your citizenship, you don't just simply drop your tax obligation when that happens. What happens is the government says, okay, at the time that you renounced your citizenship, the total amount of stock you owned is worth, say, X, and then you're going to pay a tax of 15% of that or 15% on the gain. And the key thing here is by renouncing his citizenship, he did this back in September, several months before Facebook's IPO, it makes it much easier for his tax advisors. It gives them much more wiggle room to determine what the value is of the stock. For instance, you know, right now at the high end of the IPO valuation, Saverin stock is estimated to be worth about $3.8 billion. But once the company is actually public, you know, there isn't much wiggle room in that figure. You know what the stock is worth. When it's not public, there's a lot of different factors that go into determining what it's worth and therefore determining what his tax bill will be when he drops his citizenship.
And his spokesman says that it's more practical for him to live in Singapore.
Is there any question that he's doing this for tax purposes since – I mean, I guess you could go and live in Singapore and not renounce your U.S. citizenship. You could just keep both, right?
Yeah, you could do that, but then you don't get the tax benefit. I mean, look, I don't know, you know, I don't know him. I don't know his situation well enough, but obviously there are enormous tax benefits to doing this. And actually, you know, the benefits are even greater than kind of the way I laid them out, because the reality is that, you know, the U.S. imposes essentially an exit tax at the time you renounce your citizenship, but then even that can be deferred. So, for instance, you know, not only does it give him the ability to claim some wiggle room on the value of his Facebook shares, but then he doesn't actually have to pay the capital gains tax at the time of the renunciation of the citizenship. That can be deferred indefinitely, and he just has to pay a little bit of interest every year. And then there are no capital gains taxes in Singapore, so any future appreciation in his Facebook stock is tax-free, capital gains tax-free, both in the U.S. and then there, because there's no capital gains tax in Singapore.
Jesse, is there any attempt in Washington to try to deal with this kind of thing and make sure that that it doesn't – it's not quite as easy to avoid tax obligations like this?
Well, you know, it's funny that you ask that, because in 2008, Congress passed a new law, Section 877, capital A of the Internal Revenue Code, which theoretically was supposed to make these type of expatriations more expensive by making it much clearer what your tax obligation would be. But the data shows that the number of people renouncing their citizenship has actually gone up pretty significantly since then. I think from something on the order of 400 a year, I could be getting these numbers wrong, 300 or 400 a year, I think around to around 1,700 in the most recent year. In the grand scheme of, you know, a country, the U.S. has 300 million people, it's a very small number, but it is a noticeable increase in the number of people doing that. And, you know, one theory for that is that it means that, you know, previously, you know, there were a lot of negative connotations associated with giving up your citizenship. Now, under the new tax law, there's a very concrete price that you can attach to it, and so you can essentially do the math and figure out if it's worth it, because you know precisely how much it'll be worth.
In other words, if you can say, look, I paid my taxes, it's not like I'm avoiding taxes, I've settled my account with the government.
Well, no, you are avoiding taxes. I mean, you're definitely avoiding taxes doing this. You're avoiding them both in the future, because you're not going to pay U.S. taxes on future appreciation in your stock. And then you're even really avoiding them on the exit tax, because you can defer that indefinitely.
But you're saying there might be less stigma because you have officially settled your accounts.
I don't know that there's necessarily less stigma. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that before it was kind of stigma compared to some slightly unknown thing. Now it's stigma compared to a concrete dollar figure. And you can say, okay, if I know precisely how much money I'm going to save on my taxes from doing that, well, then you can weigh that against the stigma and decide whether it's worth it.
You can work out the economics in your head. All right. Thank you very much. Jesse Drucker, a very hardworking reporter from Bloomberg News. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, in New York this week, the TV networks are unveiling their fall schedules to advertisers at an event called the Upfronts. As Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, some of the biggest suspense isn't about what shows will be on, but when.
The Upfronts are about selling ads, sure, but they're also a chance for the networks to reveal the lineup, which shows are in, on their way in, and out.
These are like game time decisions, to coin a sports phrase.
Brad Adgate is an analyst at Horizon Media. Scheduling the network's lineup, he says, is tricky. You want your hit comedy leading into your new comedy, and you don't want your police procedural going up against CSI.
It's almost like putting together a jigsaw puzzle.
DVRs and on-demand are changing how these pieces fit together, but they still matter. Joe Adalian from Vulture.com calls TV scheduling a scientific art.
Those of us who cover TV like to think of it more of as an art, because we like to think of these brave scheduling jockeys who are, you know, trusting their gut and working on instinct.
But he says there's a whole lot of research that goes on behind the scenes with input from the network's sales department. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Plans to build hundreds of new wind turbines here in California are being held up by a lawsuit from environmentalists. The worry is that the wind farms could harm this. Believe it or not, those grunts are coming from baby California condors, endangered birds who happen to like windy places. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
We all know that wind turbines kill birds, but if a California condor has a fatal attraction to one of those gigantic turbines, expect front page headlines.
Sure, it's a concern, and we take it very seriously.
Nancy Rader speaks for wind companies that do business in California. She says they're doing everything they can to avoid killing North America's largest land bird. And it's not just because the condor is an endangered species with a freakishly long wingspan. This bald-headed, weak-toed vulture also has a lot of friends. And they're watching the condor like a hawk.
Every bird in the wild have transmitters on them, either on the tail feathers or on the wings.
Vince Gurwey is just one in an army of volunteers, wildlife biologists, birders, and zookeepers obsessed with saving these ugly birds from extinction. Gurwey alone spends hundreds of hours a year tracking their movements and their nesting places in Southern California.
Last year, I drove 3,000 or 4,000 miles. And
you're paying for your own gas, I take it.
Yes, ma'am, I sure am.
Gurwey says the government's even put solar-powered GPS devices on some of the birds at $3,000 a pop. There are now about 400 condors in the western U.S., but half of them are still in protective breeding programs. And people like Kim Delfino at Defenders of Wildlife aren't about to let renewable energy ruin the condor's fragile success story, even if wind power is green.
We want to see wind prevail, but we also want to see it done smartly.
Industry insists wind turbines are a small and theoretical threat to the condor, but wind operators theoretically could face jail time under the Endangered Species Act if a turbine kills one of these bald-headed wonders. Industry is investigating ways to avoid a tragedy, including a costly solution, emerging radar technology that could temporarily shut down a wind turbine when the big birds fly too close for comfort. In Ventura, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Today's the first day of Bike to Work Week. But what if you don't own a bike? Well, many cities are launching bike share or bike rental programs for commuters to pick up a bike at a nearby station and then drop it off closer to where they're going. Citibank has just announced it'll spend $41 million to help a bike share program in New York. Andrea Bernstein reports from the Transportation Nation Project at WNYC.
There are bike shares popping up in U.S. cities. Washington, D.C. has one. So do Boston, Minneapolis, Denver. You pay a membership fee, then you can borrow a bike for a short one-way trip. But New York's bike share will be so large it will dwarf the others. That's a risk, but also a big marketing opportunity. At the rollout of the new bikes, Mayor Michael Bloomberg kept saying Citibank instead of Citibike.
The Citibank program will have all the essential safety features cyclists and drivers need. Citibank handlebars.
And then he mocked himself.
The person who I have the pleasure of introducing next hopes that everyone confuses Citibike with Citibank.
That person is Vikram Pandit, Citibank's CEO. For Pandit, it's all about getting his bank's name out there.
We think that this is a very innovative program. It makes people's lives easier.
New Balance Shoe sponsored Boston's program, but in London, another bank did, Barclays. Londoner Lisa Lipshaw, who worked on London's bike share, says Barclays' bet paid off.
Definitely, they did really well out of the sponsorship because it was a bit of a risk for them to sponsor.
Even though there won't be any bikes until July, Citibank's sponsorship already seems pretty well known on the streets of New York.
Did you hear that Citibank was sponsoring it?
Yes, very familiar.
Look, isn't it Citibank that's now sponsoring it?
But web designer Antonio Ortiz says he's skeptical in light of Big Bank's role in the recent financial crisis.
That's like some kind of subversive way of being, hey, we're buying PR, we're being good, and you know, we care about the environment and people, the community.
But then he added, bike share is probably good for the city. The one with the Y. And the one with the I. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
And finally, in the novel Player Piano, Jeremy, you may remember Kurt Vonnegut talked about lights-out manufacturing.
Yep.
No humans, right? And all robots. The idea was they wouldn't even need to keep the lights on at the factory because the robots are doing everything. Well, now, 60 years later, comes word that you could soon be holding a sophisticated piece of consumer electronics manufactured only by robots.
Hmm.
It's the planet Canon, the Japanese digital camera company. They think they might be able to pull this off by about 2015. It's a bid to combat competition from countries with cheaper labor. You know which countries they're talking about. But Canon insists that all these robots will not mean somehow job cuts.
Which reminds me, David, by the way, of one of the greatest series that I've heard ever on Marketplace, which was your trip across the country from coast to coast without interacting with a single human being. You dealt only with computers and robots. And,
well, this stuff is staying in the news, isn't it? It's kind of interesting.
Exactly. Well, and by the way, if any of you did not hear that series, it's all at marketplace.org along with a whole lot of other stuff. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.